Thank you. Hi, everybody. Just in case nobody knows who we are, my name is Portia, and this is Gwendolyn. And we are representing the Morbidistat group here. And we started off with the Fantastic Four. It was Gwen, myself, Emily, and Lucas, and we're down to only two, which makes us more fantastic because we stuck through it. And we were working under the supervision of Erdal and his magnificent TA, Fatih. All right, and that's our presentation for today. So we'd like to thank, a big thank you though to Michael, Emily, and Eileen, yes, for putting up with us throughout the last 4 weeks. Also to KITP, Richard, Paul, and Boris for having us here. It's been a great experience. And Fatih, Erdal, and Yusuf for all of your help. We couldn't figure out which one to use for you. All right, so project overview, we had two kind of big branches we were seeking out to explore. One kind of, this part was pretty known, so we're aiming to go more in depth, the dihydrofolate reductase project. So it has been previously shown that mutations that accumulate in DHFR, which is represented here, confer resistance to trimethoprim or increasing concentrations of trimethoprim. But this was done using Sanger sequencing with low resolution, and it was also shown that there was strong epistatic interactions between these substitutions. And so we set out to seek to observe high resolution tracking of this DHFR evolution by deep sequencing, and also observe interpopulation dynamics using fluorescently labeled E. coli. So these are kind of all within the same experimental setup and just kind of two different directions from there. And then the second main branch was this kind of an explored area in Erdal's lab, and it was to quantify fitness in the presence of conflicting stress factors using the TOLC. So TOLC is an intermembrane channel when combined with other proteins, forms efflux pump and E. coli. And it has many functions. So it serves as colicin, which is a toxin produced by other E. coli. Entrance and also phage entrance, which would lead in cell death. And then also it serves as efflux for antibiotics and biosalts, which would result in hopefully cell survival. So we have these conflicting stress factors, and we set up to do an experiment. We have a ton of data for all of this, but we are only going to focus in on the DHFR portion.
So this is the setup of the Morbidistat. This is a setup of the Morbidistat that we have used. So this is a cartoon to explain it. So here you have the vias where we put the culture inside, and you have a magnetic bar that is shaking the cultures. And here you have the emitter and the detector. So this is helping us to get the OD of the culture. And we always have the same volume inside. And so we want the culture to be in exponential phase. So following the OD that is calculating here, if it's below the threshold that we want, we will just add media and dilute it. If it's higher than the OD that we want, we just put the drugs. And the extra volume that we have will go to the waste. So here it will always be a constant volume. And the setup that we are using is like that. You can see different vials with different cultures. And the black circle here is the holder of the emitter and the detector. So it's here. And so we can do many different experiments at the same time.
So here we are, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed the first week, ready to conquer the Morbidistat. Building it, and here is Santa Barbara's first Morbidistat. Actually, it's not completely set up because it wasn't running, but so we have this fabulous incubator that was built by Sebastian and Boris, which was great. And we have the Morbidistat here, the pumps up there at the top. I guess I should use the pointer. The pumps here, and so each of these vials would be connected to a media bottle, so the media would sit inside the incubator. And the pumps would flow the media up into the vials based on the OD and the threshold, or antibiotics, which was sitting outside of the incubator. And then our trash lines are here. All right, so using the Morbidistan to study DHFR evolution. So again, our first main goal is to detect this high resolution tracking of DHR evolution. So the idea was we set up in the 6 vials these bacteria and track their evolution over time in presence of trimethoprim. And so we wanted to detect using deep sequencing or identify using deep sequencing how these mutation or the alleles, the mutant alleles, fluctuate over time. And then also measuring interpopulation dynamics using fluorescent proteins or fluorescently labeled subpopulations. So again, the same population of E. coli, they're all differently, they're labeled differently with the fluorescent proteins, and so we wanted to detect how those subpopulations also fluctuate over time as well. So DHFR is a ubiquitous enzyme, so it's present in all organisms, and it's responsible for folate synthesis. And it is the target of trimethoprim, the antibiotic trimethoprim. And this figure was made by Yusuf, and it depicts a crystallized structure of DHFR, and the colored regions are actually the substitutions that we've identified, which we'll go over in a few moments.
So this is the experimental setups that we have used. So we have take 6 biological replicates, and we have put them in the different vials that you see here. And in every biological replicate, it's just the 3 isogenic strains of E. coli that express CFP, GFP, and M-cherry that Portia just explained you. And we have tracked them during 14 days, where we were just growing them and looking at the OD. And when it was over a threshold of OD, we were adding some drugs. And in the beginning, the first days, our stock concentration was 10 micrograms per ml, which is below the MIC of the wild type. And we have ended up at 2,000 micrograms per ml after 14 days, which is 1,000 times higher than the MIC of the wild type. So just to show you a little bit what the software of the Morbidistan gave us. So for every day, we can track the OD over the time. And you have many points, so every 10 seconds you can acquire the OD. And you can see that for day 7 of one of the vials, for example, the OD was just going up, up, up until it passed our threshold that was open 25. And we have had some drugs here. So it's for that it go down. And after it try to recover, it go again higher than the threshold. And you can see that it go down again. And you play this game a lot of time, a lot of days, and when the cells will become resistant, you will have something like that, where the OD is almost constant. So this is the evolution of trimethoprim, concentration over the time, so for these 14 days. So you see that the first day, it was it was almost the MIC of the wild type. Then the second day it was the same, and after when it reached just here, and we just put only TMP, we just switched to a higher concentration, and we play the same game until it reached a plateau, and it go until 2,000 micrograms per ml. And so what we have done, when we were doing the Morbidistan experiment, what we were doing is every day we were also freezing some samples, so we were making glycerol stock of it. And at the end of the experiments, we just took out this glycerol stock and put them again in overnight and look at how they were reacting with the at different trimethoprim concentration. And like that, we can find the MIC of every for every vial at every day. And so here you have the plots of every vials. And if you look, for example, if we focus on vial 3, for example.
So did you stopped at 2,000? You never went above 2,000 micrograms per mil?
The solubility of the TMP is.
Oh, I see, solubility.
Yeah.
2,000 micrograms.
quite a bit.
Okay, so for the VL3, for example, if you follow in the different days, you can see that, so this is the wild type, the MIC of the wild type, and more you increase the day, more you increase your MIC. And so what we have done after that is that we have made some Illumina sequencing, and we did it for the 7th first day. So thanks to Yusuf, that helped us a lot. So we managed to send it on time, and for the Illumina sequencing, so our region that we wanted to amplify is 600 base pair, which is a little bit too long for Illumina, so we just divide it in two amplicon with an overlap region here. And we got this nice results. So Richard helped us with the analysis, meaning that he wrote all the script and just plots the data. So
presenting.
We are just presenting them. So what you can see here, for example, is the different days, so the 7 days that we had for the different vials, and you see the allele frequency for every of them. And if I focus on vial one, for example, you can see that here at day 2 a mutation occurred, and the mutation just took over the population, so all of them. At day 3, all of our population was just mutated. And the same is if you go to day 3, another mutation appear and it take over the population. And in day 4, you have two mutations that appear, and one is almost taking over the population, but a small subpopulation is having the other one. And you can look at all the different plots, and for example, in VL2, you can see that there is a mutation that appears in day 3, so it just tried, and after it just didn't keep it at all. And what is also nice to see is in VL5, you have so 2 times the same color here. It means that you have one mutation on one of the amino acids that is done by 2 different nucleotides.
How many reads do you have? How deep do you read?
Don't drink.
It was a lot, yeah.
200,000.
Yeah, so but you know, but somewhere between 10^-3 and 10^-4, you run into even bigger.
Well, what's the population size in the vials, roughly?
The OD of the actual.
Numbers OD.
10^9. After some time, they reach the highest resistance levels, and they don't acquire more mutations.
But at the highest level, so when you're at this 2 milligrams per mil, does it inhibit the growth at all? Or they just grow at some wild
you're still growing.
Right in the absence?
The growth rate was very similar.
Yeah.
To wild type.
No, they still grow. It doesn't inhibit at all.
No.
Mm-mm. All right, so here is the mutations that we observed at the end of the 7 days. So here's the DHFR promoter region and the coding region. And so these mutations here that we found during this experiment was also part of the ones that were previously found in published work in our DALS lab. And then we also found these new mutations that were different, which was kind of nice to find something novel within this, within the DHFR evolution. Again.
And so just So we were talking about this Illumina sequencing, but we also have done another sequencing. So we did nanopore sequencing on the day 11. And so with the help of Josh, we made all the protocol and everything. And so what is nice with the nanopore is it's you can read, you can have longer reads. So we just needed to have one amplicon, but it's making a little bit more error. And so we have the data, but we didn't analyze them. So, but if someone wants to help.
All right, so the other thing that we did also in conjunction with this DHFR was to follow these subpopulations that are fluorescently labeled. And so I think this was something that Gwendolyn and I were most excited about, and we don't have enough time to show all of the results. But what we did really is every day that we took samples out, we took a part of that part of the samples from each of the six vials, and we diluted them down to like 2 CFU per mil, so roughly calculating out 2 CFU per mil. And we plated them out in 96 well plates, so we had like 2 plates per vial, and we let them grow for about 48 hours. And then we read the optical density and the fluorescence for all of these markers. And so one example of what the data would look like is we have our 96 well plate here, and we have if there's a signal for a GFP, it would be green, M-cherry red, CFP blue, and then if it's a mixed signal, so if it gave signal for 2 or 3 of the markers, it'd be black, and then Y is no growth. So we did this 2 plates per vial for 11 days. In fact, we have about 60 plates that we still need to read today that we don't have data for. But essentially here, I'm just going to go. Okay, so essentially here we see over the 11 days we've got, no, is it 10 days? It's about 10 days that we have the data for. We see that the CFP population pretty much takes over in these three vials, vial 1, 2, and 3. We have the frequency of the fluorescence here, and then date time on the bottom. And in every case, M-cherry kind of just goes extinct, and then GFP kind of fluctuates still. And we are interested in continuing to look at the remaining data for this assay. So really, that is just a third of everything we did. And so briefly to recap, the Morbidistat is an automated fluidic system that's used for continuous culture. And it allows us to follow the evolution of antibiotic resistance in microbes. Using deep sequencing, we were able to identify mutations that confer resistance to trimethoprim that have not been previously found. And then also we see strong selection sweeps and clonal interference between these mutations that we identified. And we were able to visualize interpopulation dynamics using the fluorescently labeled strains. And so also to end on a note, I think it was either Richard or Boris who mentioned the first day that this course tends to be competitive. And so Gwendolyn and I secretly set out to compete against all of you, against how many hours we can work in the lab. And so we roughly calculated about 200 hours that we were in lab working the past 4 weeks. And so we are the reigning champions of this competition. And this was taken late last night, so we were very tired and not all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed yet still. So that's it. Thank you for bearing with us. It was a great experience. The emojis didn't come out right. It's so sad.
When the CFP in the different vials, grown up from one clone that was already had the CFP in it?
Yeah. So our initial starting population, we had a 1:1:1 ratio of the E. coli expressing each fluorescent.
Yeah, no, but I guess I'm wondering whether they have the same founder, because this certainly looks, the naive interpretation from this would be that there's already some mutation conveying some growth advantage.
It may not within be growth, that strain?
But some growth advantage in that strain that was in the when you grew the population up.
Well, from what I understand, they were all isogenic strains, and the only difference was the marker.
But strains are never isogenic because the
Well, so they were as much, right. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess that would be a question that Yusuf or Dahl could specifically answer, but that was my interpretation of our starting culture.
But I guess in wild 6 you see the green one is taking over, right? Farther one maybe was the CFP one, then the green one is getting some more advantage somehow.
It can also be because of the number of wells where you have the CFP and the GFP. The number is not very high, so it's only 15% of the place that was covered with.
Yeah, we didn't get very much data points.
So it can also be due to the sampling.
Did you count this way just because you don't have a full cytometer?
You mean? Well, the plate reader, Gwendolyn wrote a code to actually detect like the signals within each well, and so if they were above a certain threshold and the well had growth in it, then we would assume that that well only had that stream.
This works.
Yeah. All right. Team paper.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So we're team paper, and the goal of this project. This was a project started by Steven and Paul, and the goal of this project is to try to see horizontal gene transfer happening in the lab, but in the context of microbial communities, not single species, in natural microbial communities. So, of course, to study the impact of horizontal gene transfer or on these communities and their adaptations. So this is the experiment, experimental setup. So they went to a compost in Paris and took out these 10 lovely samples. And they put each of these 10 samples in the 10 bottles and let them grow in a minimal medium when the only carbon source is a piece of paper. And they set up a multi-species evolution experiment, and I'll soon describe it. But the nice thing about paper or cellulose as a carbon source is that it's a complex carbon source. So bacteria grow slowly on it, and there are many ways to degrade it and eat it. And bacteria need microbes need one another to do it. So presumably this should maintain high diversity, like diverse communities, in this experiment.
Can you remember what the nitrogen source was?
I have no idea. I think.
Ammonia. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Has ammonia in it.
Okay. Okay, so this is the evolution experiment. You have these 10 bottles with microbes and a piece of paper. And then you let it grow for 2 weeks. Microbes colonize these pieces of paper, and they grow a little bit. And then you do vortex and dilute it, and then you have two treatments. Okay, and of course in each one of them you put a fresh piece of paper in each round of each dilution. So the first treatment is it's called the vertical treatment. This is a normal evolution experiment. You let them grow for 2 weeks and dilute, and let them grow and dilute. And the second treatment, it's what's called the horizontal treatment. So this should allow for horizontal gene transfer between different bottles. So how does it work? You take each of these 10 bottles and you centrifuge it, and you take only the supernatant, what we call like the phage juice, and then you mix all of these juices together and insert them into these horizontal treatments. So we have here microbes, and we also have like phages and pieces of DNA that they can acquire into their genomes. And so the vertical the horizontal treatments continue the same thing. Every dilution, you also insert more of these phage juices. Now, so it seems that there is a strong selection in this experimental setup for horizontal gene transfer between bottles, because it's difficult to adapt to difficult for them to adapt to grow on a paper, and so you can expect that if one bottle has bacteria that grow nicely, and so there's some genes there that could that are important for eating paper, and then you expect that there will be strong selection on it, and it will increase in frequency, and we'll see it in next bottles. Okay, so this went on for a whole year, 24 rounds of dilution, and this is the kind of data that we started with in the beginning of this project. So we have two types of sequencing data. We have sequences of isolated colonies from each of the bottles, so one colony per bottle. These are assembled into full genomes, like genomes or contigs, and we also had metagenomic sequences of each of the bottles. So, and the idea is that this is the main data analysis tool that we used. The idea is that you want to, if you take a genome from a late time point, this is only the genome that we had, by the way, and you try to map to it reads from the metagenomes. So if you do it from the same bottle, if you map reads from the same bottle, this species is present there. So you have reads that will cover the genome, and you also have a lot of reads that do not match, and they will be thrown to the bin. But if you try to map reads from an early time point, and I'm only talking about the horizontal treatment right now, okay? If you're trying to map read from an early time point, then if you had an horizontal gene transfer from another bottle, then you'll have this piece of DNA that cannot be covered, that is not covered by this this read from these time points, because this piece of DNA just didn't exist in this time point and it came from outside. This is how it looks with the data. This is a nice example. You see the coverage and the position along the contig. So there's differences in the average coverage here, but you see a really sharp drop around this area, which suggests that this is a true horizontal gene transfer or insertion into this genome. And so if you did the same analysis for a vertical bottle, then you don't expect to see these gaps that are coming from insertions, because if there is a horizontal gene transfer within the bottle, then you still have the DNA somewhere in the community, and this DNA could map here and you will see no gaps. But this is like a very simplistic story, but actually everywhere you map, you also get many of the reads that didn't originate from this genome mapping to it, because there's many conserved genes that are being mapped to, and this is really depends on how you select your threshold for deciding what to map and what to throw to the bin. But I think that for any threshold, you still get a lot of this scenario, because you have like genes that are very conserved, and so this is a problem. And another problem is that you need a really high coverage to do this analysis. This is an example where the coverage was really nice, but we also have examples when you have like very low coverage and you get many gaps just because of low coverage. So so now you'll hear about ways to say which of these gaps are really something which is a horizontal transfer, or just because of coverage. And then you'll hear more, like a more detailed analysis about specific gaps and what you find there. And you'll also see some ecological dynamics. And then I'll come back in the end and talk about a little bit of the sequencing that we did here.
Thanks, Yishai. So what I focused on during my 2 weeks working on this project was trying to answer this question of, okay, you know, in these cases which where we have low coverage, which is actually most of the early time points, how can we identify something that we think is an actual insertion event from just, you know, some area that just happened to not have reads because of poor coverage? So I made just a very simple null model of what you'd expect for these kind of uncovered regions. Here, I just assume that you basically have reads, your reads are just randomly distributed across your genome. And so given things like the coverage, the length of a read, and the length of the genome, you can work out what this distribution of these,
how are these sequencing libraries made with Illumina? Were they transposase-based libraries? Or were they choose-based libraries? They were transposase-based libraries. Okay.
Anyway, so the upshot of it is you get this exponential distribution of uncovered regions, which, you know, depends on all these parameters, and you can predict both the number of uncovered regions, these gaps, and the kind of typical length scale of these regions. And I'll show you some analysis that I've done testing this null model on metagenomes from one of the horizontal treatments mapped to a full genome from one of the late time points at that horizontal. So one of the issues with this model is that, as Ishai alluded to, coverage is extremely non-uniform across the genome. So here I've plotted the kind of a CDF of the coverage per nucleotide, and so you can see here that there's this kind of, you know, this is log-log. There's this fat tail of, you know, guys who are covered, you know, hundreds to thousands of times, and it turns out that they're significant enough that they really affect the coverage estimates, especially at the early time points where we don't have a lot of sites covered. So what I did was I came up with a couple of different ways to essentially try to, you know, like ignore these guys. And more or less what I did was I assumed that what we really had was some kind of Poisson distribution of reads, you know, at low frequencies, and then just some, you know, high frequency sites to ignore. And I had a couple of different methods of doing this filtering of reads of large coverage, and so I kind of came up with this effective coverage, if you will, of these sites on the genome. So first off, here in blue is the actual per nucleotide coverage, so the average number of times each nucleotide was hit. I mean, so that number, you know, doesn't look too bad. We have, you know, even at early time points, we have, you know, one or two per nucleotide. But when we start filtering out these reads and these kind of high frequency reads in various ways, you end up with a lot lower coverage at early time points. And so these are just two methods I used to try to do that. Yeah.
Did you stratify that for DC patterns?
I did not. Yeah, but that would be something else to do.
Yeah, and the reason that I asked about the transposase-based library is that they've mutated the transposase so that it's more promiscuous in its insertion site, but it does still have a strong insertion site bias. Mm-hmm. And something you'll often see with transposase-based libraries is a non-random dropout in coverage.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in terms of the null model, you know, you can probably tolerate like a little, you know, some, like, if coverage distances are like, say, like, you know, a factor like 50% or something, it's not going to matter too much because you get this exponential distribution, which, as I'll show in a second, like, it falls off really quickly compared to the actual distribution of these uncovered regions. So here I was more worried about these like very high coverage regions. Cool. Okay, and so now that I have some estimates for the coverage, I can try to apply my model and first just see, okay, you know, how many of these uncovered regions do I have in my data compared to these models? And so this black line here now is the number of kind of contiguous regions without any coverage in that data. So again, we're mapping these genomes from this horizontal bottle to that, you know, late time point full genome. And so early on, we have about a few thousand. It gets pretty high up here in the middle, and then it kind of comes down again. Here, I think we also had low coverage or something, so it spikes up again. But the key point is that if I, if I took my model and just plugged in the average coverage, I would get something that's completely off. That's what this blue curve is. But if I take one of my estimates where I've kind of, tossed out these regions that are really highly red, the number of gaps I predict is actually reasonably close to the model. And again, this is not me. The only fit I'm doing to the data here is taking this kind of slightly modified version of coverage. So it seemed encouraging. Now what we can do is we can actually look at the distribution of these gaps instead of just the total number and see what their lengths look like. And so here what I've done is I've plotted a CDF of the gap length distribution. So the black curve is the actual, the lengths of these length distribution of these uncovered regions. As we can see here, again, this has kind of this fat tail, right? So there's a whole bunch of guys who are pretty big. And then these dotted lines now are the CDFs predicted by various models. So this is what would happen if I'd use the average coverage, which it kind of, very underestimates. And, there's a bunch of stuff here that it thinks are gaps, which, putative insertion events, which aren't. This orange is from that kind of filtered version of the coverage. And then this green is using an exponential fit to the data. So, obviously this distribution is not actually exponential, but so I fit it just kind of on the first decade or so. And then the idea is that, these guys who are kind of, to the right of the theoretical CDF are going to be putative insertion events. Essentially, they're too large to be explained by some, simple null model. There's still, a lot of work to be done in figuring out, kind of how robust this is, how useful this is, but at least gives us a length scale. So here it says, okay, things that are longer than 10 KB are, you're not going to get by chance. And just as a sanity check, you can do this at a late time point, and you see that the null model fits pretty well. There's like maybe one region here which it would predict as being an insertion event. And then what you can then go back and do is so what these plots are is I've taken for each of these time points now, I've taken the taken the metagenome, kind of made a pile up and ran this, this analysis and asked, okay, which of these uncovered regions are longer than expected by the null model? And then here we have our, I think we had like 169 contigs just ordered by length. And the colored is where, we have reads or we don't think we have a gap, and white is where we think an insertion event might have occurred. So there's, some consistency, right? You can see actually, some of these guys are showing up in, kind of nearby time points. There's some issues like here, there's some, like a read that happened to fall in the middle of this region. So you might need to do some, further post-processing, smoothing, whatever. And occasionally you'll get things that you'll see at one time point, but not another. But overall, I think it just gives you a way of trying to, narrow your search down. Because you're searching for through all these regions of the genome, you want to try to filter out things. And again, when you look at late time points, it, everything gets filled in. So, and I think Nick will talk to us. Oh, sorry.
Can you clarify what you're mapping against?
Yeah. So there's whole gene. So basically, individuals were isolated, one from each of these bottles at one of the later time points, mm-hmm. and then whole genome sequence. So you have a whole genome sequence of, I think this is Pseudomonas,
okay.
But...
What relative abundance is that, sort of, how does the relative abundance of those isolates change throughout?
Yeah, so it starts off, so for this guy, I think he starts off pretty low. I think it was like, kind of less than 1%. At around time 10, he gets to about maybe like a couple percent or a few percent. Kind of hard to tell because you're not quite sure, which of the reads mapping here are actually from him or from, like some relative. And then it goes down again at late time points. So kind of, highest few percent, but as low as kind of, tenth of the percent.
And do you see that impacting your ability to call the gaps in terms of the coverage?
Yeah, and it's not exactly correlated. Like there's some, because there's some time points where just like you just have less metagenome reads total. So both of those are definitely issues that lead to this kind of coverage problem. Now I think Nick will talk about an orthogonal way to find these events.
All right, so yeah, I took a slightly different approach that was not based on kind of a random mapping model, and I decided to leverage the information in the paired end reads. So in this, I think it was roughly 500 base pair segments, and the reads themselves were 150 base pairs. So you would expect, on average, that they should have about 200 base pairs between paired end reads when they map. So I guess for all the discussion that follows, what I'll be doing is taking the metagenome from time point 16 or dilution step 16 vertical bottle, and I'll be mapping it onto the horizontal bottle reference genome. And I'll be trying to see if I can use the paired end reads to kind of interrogate these putative insertion events. And so, yeah, so that's what this little diagram is doing. I just kind of map the paired end reads as just singletons, and then look at the distribution of distances between those reads. And what you see is exactly what I alluded to before, is that the distribution is roughly consistent with what you would expect from the sequencing parameters. But unfortunately, I was kind of hoping for maybe a bimodal distribution or something kind of, but it's pretty smooth, so it's going to be an arbitrary cutoff on what I say is large distance and what is typical distance. So I took about 90% cutoff region. So everything in red I took as paired end reads that may be mapped across an insertion, and everything green was mapped just, you know, like you would expect. And this was used in conjunction with the coverage measurement. So then you can make a pileup of all those reads in green, and you can look at for regions. Regions with zero coverage, and also that they're flanked by paired end reads. And so those in conjunction would be a putative insertion event. So here in blue, I'm showing you kind of the coverage pileup of all those green paired end reads. And then in orange, what I did was every time you hit a paired end read in the red region, you just add one. And then when you hit its conjugate pair, you subtract one. So this is kind of a cumulative, just to show that these actually line up quite well. So you would expect naively that that should be an insertion. And then what I did was I went to the reference genome from the horizontal bottle at time point 16. I took all these regions, and I just cut them out. And I was going to look for reads that actually spanned this junction. So using this kind of methodology, I found 103 kind of putative insertion we thought could be. So basically the idea is, if this actually was an insertion event, there should be reads that map across this region. So then I kept track of where I made these cuts, and I looked at the coverage of the mapping on these new kind of cut reference genomes. And so these are the distributions of coverages. So in blue is basically the coverage along these new kind of cut reference genomes, and in orange are the subselected sites of these cuts. And so maybe you could convince yourself, oh, this tail kind of could be real insertion events. But, you know, luckily Mr. Kolmogorov tells us a nice way to ask if these distributions are sampled from the same distribution. And you get a p-value of 0.3. So there's a 30% probability that these are actually pulled from the same distribution. So what I can say is that there's little statistical significance here to call gaps, at least with the data that we have, gaps as in putative insertion events. So what could you do? You could either increase your sequencing throughput, use HiSeq and get 100 times more data, or you could really say, I believe this tail, and you go PCR those junctions. Those are probably the two ways you should do it. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So after we use this statistical method to find good candidates, it's time to get down the rabbit hole and try to really look at one of those putative insertion position. We will only stay at the entrance though, because this hole runs deep and we have only so much time. So we will look at one of the contigs, the contig 23 from the metagenome, from the genome that was isolated from time 16 bottle H5. And this is This config maps against all of the metagenome. This is only a small fraction of the awe-inspiring amount of data we managed to get out of this experiment, because we have maybe 1,000 times more of those images. And this is why we need a statistical approach to really find good candidates before going deeper. So here you can see in this region what seems to be a gap. And when we superimpose the Attish null model on this to find which region are less covered than from the null model, we see that so here you have all the metagenomes. Each line is a metagenome, and there is a color and there is a mapping at 95% identity. And for some of the metagenome, we are not the null model does not predict that this apparent gap is surprising because the coverage is so poor. So it's a strong indication to try to go deeper in the sequencing. In some of them, so clearly here, this sequence was present in the bottle, and this is the bottle from which the cell were isolated, which is a good thing. And one of the original objectives was to try to find compelling arguments to say that this actual sequence, which is here, comes from another bottle. And I am yet to find a really good example which makes sense according to the experimental setup, because here you can see that this sequence is also found in one of the vertical bottles and not in any other horizontal. So it might be an insertion event that is older than the beginning of the experiment. But we have plenty of other candidates to look at, and I took this one because we did a lot of stuff on it in order to give you a flavor of what kind of analysis we can do out of this data. So if we look at this config, this is the coverage of the vertical bottle over the horizontal bottle at the same time 16, and we start by looking at the GC content, and we see that there is quite a drop. Pseudomonas is GC rich, and this region seems to be odd, so it might be the sign of an insertion event, but it also might explain part of the drop in coverage, even though this drop in GC content do not prevent the fact that this gap, this region is well covered when you map the metagenome against the genome from the same bottle. So this is an argument to say that it's not only the GC bias. And then when you look in more details at the gap region, you can do several kind of analysis. So the pair ends reads that Nick talked about, that you can see on both sides. The protein annotation, so you see that you have some porins and other enzymes that are on this region. And this region is flanked by two tRNAs, which is also an argument to say that this is a laterally transferred region, because what happened is that if you have a circular piece of DNA bearing a tRNA, it can align on the genome, and then you have a crossing over, and you will end up with the inserted region with two tRNA flanking it. So here you have one tRNA here and one other here, and the idea was to look at the reads that map this exact region. So here they are. You have a few reads that map this exact region each time. So each pileup is a read, and all those reads mapped at three points in the config. So these are the reads that map at several places in the same config. So in green, in orange, and in blue, you see that this small sequence was repeated three times across this config. So it's again an argument to say that it's an insertion point, because we have the junction on one side at least in green, and on the other side it's slightly less convincing, because what you see is that you can take the sequence from the reads and run it another software in order to predict tRNAs, and the red region that you have here is the predicted tRNA. So on the green side here, we have the tRNA plus a little bit of the rest of the sequence. Oops, sorry. But on the other side, it's not that clear yet. So we need to maybe sequence deeper in order to find the proper junction, which read that really cover the insertion, the putative insertion points.
All right, so we've taken up a lot of time already. But instead of gaps, I wanted to sort of look at the big picture. And so we took all the metagenomes, ran them through MGRAS, and sort of just asked who's there. And I'm just going to skip this. The idea that I wanted to look at was the stuff that's there in the beginning and abundant at the beginning, what happens to that, and the stuff that's abundant at the end, where does it come from? And so that's what it did here. So in red, those are the ones that are abundant initially. I took the 20 most abundant ones, and final are the 20 most abundant at the end, and black are the ones that are present in both. And I'm sure you could stare at this for a long time. I'm just going to run you through the bottles, and there's just going to be one message, which is this is not just noisy. This is completely messy, I think. So either the 16S data is really bad, and so we tried running it, or we did run it through Diamond and Megan, but apparently the runs are still not done, so we didn't have a full table of things to look at. So maybe that would give you better information, but maybe this also just means that there's just a ton of stuff going on. And you don't really know what it could be. If you correlate all the things against each other, it's actually not completely crazy, which is sort of surprising. So this is the initial frequency versus the final frequency for all the bottles and all the abundances. And the correlation is actually pretty okay. I mean, I'm not saying this is perfectly correlated, but it's not as crazy as it could be. So there's some structure to this chaos.
On the log or on the linear?
On the linear, yeah. So, but. No, that's right. These few points dominate it, but still, you know, it could be all over the place.
Did you do an experiment?
Hmm?
Do you get like a rank correlation?
I don't remember whether this is the R squared or the actual correlation coefficient. Yeah, but both are sort of not zero. So, that was like the main point: is it zero or not? Yeah.
The theorem,
but not
the endpoint, is on zero.
That's right. All right. Somebody else talk about this? We can also skip it. I'll just do it briefly.
Metabolism was surprisingly constant over all our populations, and probably the most hits was this full nitrogen cycle of intake with nitrogen. This was surprising because particularly this pathway of, they were supplying ammonia, but this whole pathway was very well represented. So there seems to be constant nitrogen being flown through this community in all bottles. Okay.
Okay, hi again. And so I guess you saw some nice analysis on this stuff and some pretty strong evidence that some of these gaps really represent horizontal gene transfer or insertion from another bottle. But I guess the strongest evidence would be to find two genomes of the same bug, one from an initial time point and one from a late time point. And then you see them matching really nicely to one another, except for these few insertions or also deletion events. And then you can say for sure that you had DNA insertion. So this is, we wanted to take like a small step towards this goal, and we wanted to find genomes from that match one another from two time points. So the first goal was to go to one bottle and look for trying to sequence many isolates and find this match. Long story short, we only ended up sequencing 8 isolates and we didn't find a match. Then we thought about like maybe quicker way to do this, more efficiently. We thought of trying to sequence metagenomes, and with nanopore we might be able to assemble full genomes, and then again we might have matches from early and late time points. But so we tried two times to sequence metagenomes with the nanopore, and two times it failed. Flow cell was not okay. But I want to leave you with hope. So another thing that was going on here is that Stephen was looking at all of the genomes that we already had from late time points and looking at the RecA gene there, which is very conserved. And now he designed primers to go to hunt for these exact genomes in the early time point, so with a colony PCR of isolate. So so this is one future plan. Another is, of course, to sequence much deeper, because this would be really improve the analysis. And another goal is to do some functional analysis. They have a way to measure cellulose degradation, and then this could also see some stuff. And so that's it. We wanted to thank everybody in KITP, in the lab, and Paul, Stephen, and Guillaume. And yeah, thank you all.
All right. So we're coming to our last presentation by Team Pink.
So as I mentioned before, we're working with the Pink Berries Microbial Consortium. So each of us will go through what is it that we found the pink berries to be of interest, and we'll go through some of the results we've got so far. And if time allows, I'd like to go over some of the preliminary work that we've done on the kelp-associated microbiome in the past few weeks. So back to the pink berries. So if we do fluorescent in situ hybridization of the pinkberry microbial aggregates, this is probably what we'll see. We'll have green cells that are sulfur-reducing bacteria, and we'll have like circular cells that are pearl-sulfur bacteria. So back in week one of this course, Lizzie has already mentioned the metabolism that shared between the two sulfur bacteria. But what I'm interested in is actually the other cells that make up the microbial aggregate. So the sulfur reducers and the purple sulfur bacteria sort of make about 50 to 60% of the microbial aggregate, but there are other cells that are there as well. So in particular, I'm interested in the bacteroidetes and the alpha proteobacteria. So together, these two classes of bacteria sort of make up about 20% of the pink berries. So the three bacteroidetes that are shown here and the two alpha proteobacteria shown here, they're always present in the different pink berries aggregates. So it seems to suggest that they might be contributing to some sort of functions within the pink berries. So I'm particularly interested in what sort of metabolism that they carry out, what sort of nutrients that they are using within that community.
Sorry, those percentages are how close they are to?
So yeah, they're the 16S full-length similarity to type strains that are on the NCBI server. Yeah.
So some of them, the closest ones,
10%. Yeah. So I don't think many of them have actual cultures available at the moment. So one of the closest ones is the PBA1. Okay. So what's interesting is that, so we've got this example of the bacteroides and the alpha proteobacteria coexisting in the same environment within the pink berry. So there are actually other examples of bacteroides and proteobacteria coexisting together in other ecosystems. One of the ecosystems that I'm more familiar with is the mammalian gut. So in the mammalian gut, there's a lot of proteobacteria and a lot of bacteroidetes. So in this paper, they actually looked at the carbon sources that the proteobacteria E. coli prefers and what the bacteroidetes prefer. And you can see that the proteobacteria tends to prefer monosaccharides, very simple sugars, simple carbohydrates, whereas the bacteroidetes here, they tend to prefer complex carbohydrates, and they can also use monosaccharides. So they have a pretty broad range of nutrient substrate utilization genes. So what I want to address in this course is whether the marine or the pinkberry bacteroides and alpha proteobacteria sort of follow this rule. Do they do the pinkberry bacteroides use complex polysaccharides as their nutrient source, and the alpha proteobacteria in the pinkberries would utilize the monosaccharides within the aggregate. I'm also interested in what sort of differences are there between the intestinal bacteroides and the pinkberries bacteroides. So luckily we've got some Illumina data from Lizzie. So we've got some beamed genomes of the three bacteroides and the two alpha proteobacteria that I'm interested in. And so those genes are annotated by the IMG server. So I particularly look for genes that encode for the caszymes, which are the carbohydrates active enzymes. So these classes of enzymes, they tend to degrade or modify complex carbohydrates for the bacteria to use. And I also look for peptidases, so enzymes that that can catalyze degradation of polymers. So if, say, the bacteria has these genes, so to me it seems to suggest that they would prefer to use complex carbohydrates or polysaccharides as nutrient source over monosaccharides. I also look for ABC transporters in those annotators genes specific for monosaccharides and amino acids. So say if the alpha proteobacteria has a lot of these ABC transporters, it seems to suggest that they are like scavengers that would just mop up any simple sugars in the environment and utilize that in the cell. I also want to look for pigment production or light-driven pathways to see whether any of these five organisms can utilize light energy for like photosynthesis or other pathways.
Sorry, just to back up a little bit, we weren't here the first week. And so the pinkberry is sort of one of them, the primary bacteria is photosynthetic.
Yes.
And so, but that's the only, that's the sort of primary producer, and the others are.
We don't know. We don't know. So that's why I'm kind of doing some data mining to see whether they're obtaining energy from light or like they have to scavenge like simple sugars or like byproducts produced by other bacteria within that microbial aggregate. So there are a lot of enzymes that fall under the caszyme category. So these are the two key ones that I want to point out. So glycosyl hydrolases, it catalyzes the degradation of complex carbohydrates. So what I found is that in the two intestinal bacteroides genomes that I looked into, they have a lot of glycosyl hydrolases per megabases in their genome, which is not surprising. We found that the three bacteroides within the pinkberries, so the three organisms here, they also have quite a few genes that encode this class of enzymes in their genomes, whereas the alpha proteobacteria in the pinkberries, they don't have any at all. What's interesting is that the pinkberry bacteroides, they actually have a lot of genes that encode amylases, and amylases are a class of enzymes that can degrade complex carbohydrates such as starch. So to me, this suggests that they can utilize starch as their carbon sources and produce ATP.
Is that extracellular, or is
it degradation that extracellular? So with complex carbohydrate degradation, they because it's a very big molecule, so what they tend to do is that they start to chop it off at the outer membrane, and they would have transporters that kind of feeds like little bits of the carbohydrate into the cell and then do more degradation in the cell. So during that cleavage process, there could be some, you know, smaller molecules or monosaccharides that kind of floats away, and I think that maybe why the proteobacteria can survive off that. So this is just purely speculation. Yeah. So, in terms of peptidase, so there's actually a quite, they have very different number of peptidases. So the PBA one of the alpha proteobacteria has a lot of peptidases, the other doesn't. But what's interesting is that the alpha proteobacteria that has a lot of peptidases, it actually has very little monosaccharides or amino acids transporters. So that suggests that this PBA1 would prefer a complex polymer, whereas PBA2, they have a preference for simple sugars and amino acids. So that means that I think the PBA1 and A2, they occupy very different niches within the pinkberry aggregates, so that might suggest why they coexist together. What's also interesting is that the PBA2, they also have a set of photosynthetic regulatory genes. So it seems to suggest that they can carry out photosynthesis or use light energy for some sort of function. So what about the bacteroidetes in the pinkberries? Can they use light as an energy source? So it turns out the free bacteroidetes within the pinkberries, they have genes that encode proteorhodopsin, and proteorhodopsin can actually convert light energy, create a proton gradient, and it actually encourage ATP synthesis through that pathway. But because these bacteroidetes have amylases and other enzymes that degrade complex carbohydrates, I'm thinking that this particular pathway, it's kind of like a snack or like a dessert for the bacteroidetes. It's not like the main source of energy. So I don't think that they are obligate phototrophs, but they are able to use light for specific functions. So while I was looking at the proteorhodopsin, I also came across some genes within the bacteroidetes that encode pigments, such as the beta-carotene pigments. So what's really interesting to me is that these marine bacteroidetes have pigmentation, but the gut bacteroidetes don't. So what are the pigments there for? Are they therefore, photosynthesis, are they useful for like UV protection, such as like sunscreen for like bacteria? Are they therefore defense mechanisms? So there are some possibilities, but we don't know what they're there for. So to actually confirm the function of these pigments, we actually need some live pinkberry bacteroidetes to actually carry out some phenotypic assays to confirm the roles. So what I did next was to try to revive any of the viable cells that we've got in the frozen pinkberries that Lizzie collected many years ago. So because the pinkberries were just stored frozen in the freezer, and the pinkberries are actually held together by a very gooey substance. So I think that there might be some viable cells, might as well try it. So I got about 40 or 50 of these pink berries. You can see that there are some crap mixed in the freezer stock. So what I do is that I separated out the pink berries, wash it twice with the growth media before I make a pink berry smoothie with the standing mortar and pestle. So what I did next was that I tried to crush it as finely as possible, take out the supernatant, dilute it down to 10 to the minus 4, and plate it out on two different media. So one of the media that I used was the typical seawater complete media, and the other one is one with starch supplementation, because based on the metagenome evidence, it seems like the bacteroidetes have amylases, so they should be able to utilize starch. So I added that, and we can see a lot more growth on the plates that has starch in it. So after a few days, we can see some pigmented colonies. So there are actually at least six different distinct colony morphologies on these plates. So at the moment, I was just restreaking some of them. Hopefully we've got some pure isolates that Lizzie and her team can work on in future projects. So that's that. So hopefully we can do some 16S sequencing on those isolates to confirm that they are actually the free bacteroidetes that we found from the metagenome data. it will be very interesting to actually characterize their metabolic capacity on their own to see what they are capable of. And so as I mentioned before, the pink berry aggregates are actually held together by this gooey substance. So in the gut, bacteroides like to degrade mucin, which is like a glycoprotein, another gooey substance. So what I was thinking is that maybe the bacteroides in the pink berries can actually utilize this glue as a nutrient source as well. No one has actually characterized what's the biochemical profile of this matrixes, so I think that's a pretty interesting direction to take in future projects. Yes. So I'll let Matt talk about his project.
Okay, so the basic question that I would like to answer with this data set is just, what is the population structure of these pink berries? And in particular, how clonal are they? That question can be answered in kind of two completely distinct ways. One of them being, how similar are different berries in terms of their species abundances? So that's one thing I'd like to look at. The other thing is, within a single berry, and within species of that single berry, what kind of strain level diversity is present? And so those are kind of the two different things I'd like to look at. And finally, I'd also like to, you know, using this data, I'd like to look at what a snapshot of this genetic diversity can tell us about potential evolutionary forces that are present within these berries. So we'd like to infer things like selection and homologous recombination. Okay, so the first thing I did with this data is I took I took a set of Illumina MiSeq short reads that are 250 base pairs long, and I mapped them to several different reference genomes that have been created by Lizzie, using mostly different samples. There was some overlap with berry 9, but it's mostly different. And you can see here that so most of the reads mapped to a reference genome. This column on the right here is the percent of reads that didn't map to any of our reference genomes. And you can also see that the majority in each case, in each of the berry, the species of the greatest abundance is this purple sulfur bacteria. You can also see that each of the berries have this sulfate-reducing bacteria, as well as several of these alpha proteobacteria, and then the bacteroides right here. So you can see that there's like kind of a good amount of difference between the different berries in terms of what their species abundances are. And there's also differences, like, you know, within the alpha proteobacteria, there are huge differences. For instance, in berry number 2, there's this huge excess of A3. A3 corresponds to the microvibrio, if anyone is interested. Another way to visualize this is just to separate out these histograms into different berries, right? And, you know, I've also, in these plots, I've normalized things by the average coverage across the genome. So you can just get a sense of what our coverage is. Right. The key thing being that for this purple sulfur bacteria, we have coverage in excess of 100x. So that really allows us to look at some of the SNPs that are present in the population and say something about those allele frequencies. Okay, and you know, one other thing that we can look at is just for each of these different, you know, potential species or whatever we're calling them, we can look at a subset, or like a random sample of the reads across the genome, right, from 0 to 8 megabase pairs, and we can look at the percent nucleotide identity. What you see is that a very large fraction of the reads map with greater than 95%. And so this is something that's been seen in several other papers that, you know, kind of gives more confidence that these are actually sort of like distinct subpopulations. Okay, and you know, so what I just showed was kind of like the average nucleotide identity mapped to these different species. Using that, what we can do after mapping the reads, we can create a pileup of all the reads at each position in the genome. We can identify which loci are polymorphic, and then we can compute the allele frequencies. This is just based on the number of reads with a minor allele frequency to the total number of reads at a particular locus. And, you know, averaging that together, we can compute pi. right? This is a pairwise heterozygosity. It's just the probability that two randomly chosen individuals are different at a randomly chosen site.
This is randomly chosen individuals from the same berry.
Yeah, this is from the same species, right? So these are four different species within berry 2, 3, 4, and 5. So crucially, we have these different samples from the different berries that are separate. And so you can see, like, you know, these numbers here are not really anything, you know, too crazy. You know, they range from around 2 to 4%, but it suggests that these are definitely not clonal, right? You know, this is typical of, you know, bacterial populations in the wild that are thought to possess a pretty large amount of diversity. So you're saying just pool all of the reads from, you know, each of these berries, and yeah, I haven't. So that's definitely a really good thing to look at, right? Like, maybe the diversity within berry 2 is the same as if you just pooled 2 and 3 together, and they really came from, you know, some, you know, mixed, well-mixed clonal population. I haven't looked at that, but that's kind of the thing I'd really like to get at with this data. The distribution of heterozygosity. So you mean?
Like within a particular species in berry,
like frequency.
Yeah, so I actually have that right here. Yeah. Do you mean like across different positions in the genome? Like, yeah, I did compute that. And yeah, I didn't put that in the slides. But like.
And I'm just wondering if there's any evidence for mole break.
Yeah.
50% divergence, that didn't come about in berry, right? It's
like right. Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely something I'd like to look at. But yeah, I don't have that at the moment.
Did you look at the synonymous and non-synonymous?
No, though that should in principle be pretty easy to do because we have the annotations. So I just haven't gotten around to doing that. But
what's your coverage of what's the height of the pileup?
Well, the coverage is, you know, for I'm looking at berry 2, so 100x, yeah. Although, yeah, it is, the coverage is, you know, somewhat variable. So there are certain regions with quite high coverage. And the regions with low coverage, I'm just not really considering those. But anyways, here's our site frequency spectrum. So this is a histogram of allele frequencies, right? For instance, you know, we found this many counts of minor alleles that were present at frequency 0.2 for the different species. And also here, I mean, yeah, I haven't had a chance to really analyze this, you know, too much, but it kind of looks somewhat neutral-ish. If you plot the expectation from a null model, it would be roughly the same shape. You know, this you might if you saw something that was like non-monotonic and had an uptick here, you might be able to comment about selection or other forces. But here, we don't really see anything that strongly indicates selection. Although that's definitely a topic for further to look further into. So this is the site frequency spectrum in one dimension, right? We're just looking at a histogram of, you know, single allele frequencies. But actually, with these short reads, we can actually observe cases where there are pairs of SNPs on the same read. And what we can do is we can make site frequency spectrum in two dimensions, right? So here we're kind of counting up all of these SNP pairs that occurred on a single read. And we're saying how many SNP pairs had one allele frequency at point two, and the other allele present at, say, 0.4, right? That would be this box here. And that generates this histogram right here. Of course, a natural thing to ask is whether this kind of joint frequency histogram is just, you know, basically whether the two sites are independent of one another, whether this histogram here is really just kind of the product of single site frequency spectrums. So what we can do is we can look at the enrichment. So are the two frequencies independently drawn from the one-dimensional spectrum? So we can look at the enrichment of each of these frequency combination pairs, right? That's the number of SNP pairs, say with frequency FA and FB, divided by the number that you would expect if you drew independently from this site frequency spectrum. Right, so any color that's on the red side of the spectrum means it was enriched, and blue means it was unenriched. And we can see that this diagonal here appears to be enriched compared to the independent sites expectation.
These are ones we're seeing on the same read.
Same read, so 250 base pair reads.
Did you
use
a function of distance within the read?
I did, yeah. So that was my next slide. Like, what we can first do is just restrict the analysis to SNP pairs separated by less than 50 nucleotides. And you can see, I think that's the same exact plot. There's a problem here. But yeah, what you can see here is like for between 50 and 100, you can see that these correlations start decaying a little bit, right? And as you go further and further away, you see more and more decay in these correlations. And so this kind of indicates that there's some decay in the amount of linkage disequilibrium as you look at pairs that are separated by a longer distance. It decays, yeah, within a 250 base pair on this length scale of about 100 nucleotides or so. So one way to summarize this is to look at this linkage disequilibrium coefficient R squared. So R squared here is kind of like this measure of the deviation from the independent sites prediction. And you can see that, yeah, this R squared kind of strongly decays on a length scale of around, I don't know, 50 or 100 base pairs. You can also plot 1 over R squared, right? So as you go down, you get more and more linked. And you can see this linkage really decays towards higher SNP separations. So this is, I guess I should definitely comment that this is only a subset of the data. Like, I just didn't have time to look at each of these pairs of SNPs. There's actually like millions of pairs that you can look at. And so this is a small sample. If you continue processing the data, you might be able to resolve some of this noise. And you could comment on things like the slope of this right here is some measure of like the expected number of recombination events since two individuals share a common ancestor. So it's like the product of R times the effective population size is the slope of this. And so you could estimate that. You could also say something about like the length scale of a over which recombination acts based on like the fact that this isn't, whether or not this is saturating or not. It doesn't really appear to be saturating yet by 250 nucleotides, but it's hard to tell with some of this noise. So we just have to kind of look at more data, and then we could maybe say more. But that's pretty much it. So a lot of this analysis was motivated by these two papers. So everything to do with linkage, I kind of was trying to reproduce what goes on in this paper. And then the species abundance profiles, I kind of followed some of the methods in this paper. Anyway, so I guess Michael will talk about diversity from a slightly different perspective.
Yeah, so I was interested in looking at CRISPRs because they represent sort of like a different way to get at the time dynamics that these bacterial populations undergo. And so, so when a bacteria with CRISPRs encounters like a foreign piece of DNA, maybe from viruses or plasmids, it can get cut up into pieces, and then the Cas machinery can insert that DNA fragment into the CRISPR array as a spacer. And so these CRISPR arrays consist of repeat, spacer, repeat, where the repeats are the same, but the spacers are typically different. And new spacers come in preferentially at the leading spot. So that gives you sort of a chronology of what bacterial lineages, what kind of foreign DNA they encountered. And so I thought that the long read data that Lizzie had was particularly good at looking at the CRISPR arrays, particularly because it's a simple community. So there's like two big species, so you can easily get high coverage. And you can get the linkage of distant spacers, which is important for this metagenomic sample because that's something you couldn't really get out of the short read data when you're reconstructing the context. Oh, no. And so one question that I wanted to answer was, what is the population heterogeneity for these CRISPR loci? For example, like, are the spacers conserved across the population, or would you expect to find a whole bunch of unique spacers that don't appear again? Another question you could ask is, like, do you notice any trends that depend on whether you're at the older part of the array or the newer part? And in general, these questions would depend on, like, the environmental pressures that the bacteria find themselves in. And even before people understood CRISPRs, they were sort of able to resolve strain differences by looking at CRISPR arrays because they can be so heterogeneous. So the data that I looked at was these molecular long reads, which are now known as like Illumina TruSeq synthetic long reads. And so you get those by diluting down long pieces of DNA and then sequencing them. And so you end up with Illumina-like accuracy, but that you can reassemble into a read that corresponds to a long piece of DNA. And so my general pipeline was that Lizzie had a former student who had looked at the assembled contigs and extracted out the CRISPR arrays from those. So I took the repeats that she found and then looked via BLAST at the raw reads that contain those CRISPRs. And then I put that through a CRISPR finding tool, CRISPR Detect, and that extracted out repeats and spacers that I then needed to cluster and clean up basically because of several issues. So they could have different orientations. One issue with these CRISPR finders is that you can sort of get inaccurate edges for the repeats. So just especially for short arrays, it can like chop off bits at the edges. And then also sequencing errors could come into the spacers. And so some general numbers. The purple sulfur bacteria have found 6 CRISPR arrays, and 3 for the sulfur reducing bacteria, and then 30 that are just unassigned.
And 6 separate arrays in one genome.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Do you know if these are orphan arrays or if they actually have Cas genes with them?
I'm not sure. I found that some have Cas genes, but I haven't looked systematically.
Yeah, some do and some don't. We're just sort of starting to analyze that.
So here's a plot of the like largest number of spacers for each array. Versus like the number of reads, and so you see that the purple sulfur bacteria have a lot of coverage, and so it's good to look at those. So the output of my like pipeline ended up giving me these sequences of spacers and sometimes gaps. And so, but one thing I noticed while looking at it is that they often have high like syntony, so the same spacer often just follows the previous one. And so I just did a naive like alignment of those by just finding for a given sequence, if you align it without trying to introduce gaps or anything, and then you just stick it in the best spot. So this is the result of these for the most abundant repeat. And so each color here represents a spacer. Unfortunately, the colors overlap a little, so like these are not the same as like these over here, but what you end up finding is that there's very high conservation within this CRISPR loci. And in contrast, or like one interesting thing is that this particular repeat separated into 2 disjoint arrays. So what that likely meant was that this repeat represented 2 separate arrays that just had very similar repeats. And then over here, what you find is that there's still a high amount of conservation, but you end up having these gaps. And what I found by looking in the gaps was that there's transposase in here. So maybe it's a transposable element that inserted itself into the array. And so that could be interesting because if these sequences were important, now they're not really, they may not be able to get used. So this may mean that they're not under selection. you can see there's a little heterogeneity. This one does not have it. And this is over here. So.
Do you know if the transposer is in there, like, mess up very fully, or is it not used?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen anything in the literature, but.
That's a good question. I mean, I think our thinking was that at least if there had been a spacer there that had interrupted, that record has been destroyed. So
it could be the one downstream.
Yeah, whether it impedes the function further downstream, I don't know, but that's a good question.
Okay, so I'll look at the other ones. So this is the second most abundant one for the PSP. It also has a transpose ace here. But one interesting thing is that there's heterogeneity in this, like, what I would think is the leading sequence. So you can sort of resolve separate strains. So there's the ones with this leading sequence, but no green one over here. And then there's the ones without it. And then they have this green, like, spacer. And so what this may mean is that this CRISPR array sort of still functioning, and that since they last shared these spacers, this one has accumulated a whole bunch more.
For one color, how identical are they?
Some cutoff as to what you call it? Yeah, so that's part of the, like, clustering. The cutoff was sort of high, so they should be fairly, like, similar. I don't remember offhand.
I think you were, it was like at the 97% or above, right? They're nearly identical.
Yeah.
With some room for wobble on the other side.
One.
Yeah, very, very, very similar.
But I forgot to mention, actually, these molecular reads come from a 10-berry mixture. So it's possible that these strain differences are because they come in from different berries. And so we can sort of glance through the other arrays. So this one is, like, the first one, very high, like, conservation, and it has a type 1C Cas gene, which indicates it may be or is likely to be active. And this one over here has a very large number of gaps. And you can see sort of the strain level differences. And I find it sort of interesting that it's actually easiest to tell in the tail here how they're different. Like, all of these sort of group together, and then these will group together. And one interesting thing is that with these transposases, you can see that it looks like some here have gotten lost over time. And this is the one sulfur-reducing bacteria repeat. And then this one also shows some heterogeneity in, like, likely the leading sequence. And lots of, like, heterogeneity in this tail sequence, too. And so one interesting thing you could do with this is if you take these spacers and then try to look back into the metagenomic sample, are they more likely to actually map to something that may be, like, a virus or plasmid versus something back here, which would represent, like, an older sequence. So that would be something for future work. And it would also be interesting to look more closely at, like, the unique SNPs that are not easy to see in this picture.
Similar.
Just bear with us for another 5 minutes. Yeah. So apart from the pink berries, we are also interested in the microbes associated with the kelp forest in Santa Barbara. So why do we even care about kelp forests or microbes that live on it? Well, NSF cares. So they funded, like, a multi-year long project that looks at the dynamics of kelp ecosystem, but they've not really looked into the microbes at all. So what I'm interested in is whether the microbes themselves actually help the kelp forest regeneration. Kelp forests can be damaged by storm or human activity. So that's kind of the direction that I was interested in. So this is a heat map of the kelp forest distribution along the coastline. So we're here, and luckily we've got this patch of kelp forest. So during our downtime, we actually kayaked out to this particular point and sampled some kelp. So what we do is that we collected fresh kelp. We wanted to do some bacterial culturing to see if we can get any isolates out of it, do some DNA extraction, and characterize those isolates by nanopore sequencing. So in Santa Barbara, there's actually a lot of different species of kelps, but we've only sampled four different species. These are the four common ones that we found in that patch of kelp forest. So yeah, we can readily find them at Kemp's Point Beach. So we've got three different media that we wanted to try. So I mentioned this seawater complete meter in previous slide. So it's basically a bunch of salts. I also made another media, I call it kelp meter. So it's basically what we've collected from the Kemp's Point Beach. So we try to grind them up to make it more homogeneous, but unfortunately this was as finely ground as we could manage. So we autoclave it, so there's some kelp essence like in the background, but there are a lot of large kelp chunks. So Lizzie also ordered some kelp powder off Amazon, but the kelp species was actually different from what we sampled at Kemp's Point. Unfortunately, this didn't really support the growth of any kelp-associated microbes, but we found quite a few on these two media. So I mostly looked at some of these kelp. Some of them looked pretty normal, some of them looked like this. So they're like some discolored patches. So I was curious whether the microbes on these plaques are quite different from the microbes on these normal-looking slimy kelp. So these are some of the plates that we've got. So as you can see, the colony morphologies on these two media are very different. These colonies actually took 1 week to grow, whereas these ones, they popped up overnight. And they're actually quite different. Some of them actually are agar degraders, so there's actually a pit on these surfaces. So on this plate, I could see about like five or six different colony morphologies, whereas on these ones, I've got at least 10. So unfortunately, we didn't have time to characterize all of them on nanopore. So we focused our efforts on two colonies from the seawater complete meteor from the normal looking kelp. And we also got two isolates from the eelgrass. One is orange and the other one, I cannot remember what it looked like. So we've got two samples that had approximately 100 times coverage on the nanopore sequencing, so that's great. So we've got a lot of data for future work. So yeah, that's it. And acknowledgement.
All right. Pretty amazing what all of you have put together over the last 4 weeks. So congratulations to all of you. Before we all disperse and go back to the lab, there's two things we need to do. We will take a picture.
So one is, let's thank the materials leaders, the instructors.
Yes.
And,
the next one is to thank Maggie, who made all of this. Same thing that I need. Maggie, why don't you come? Because without Maggie, this would have never come together. Because of our collective inability to get things moving.
Yes.
And including one of the chief is any secrets. We, that is sort of royal we, Josh, Gary, and a bunch of people from Cheese Group.
Very cool. I'll go back and watch the talk. Thank you.
And